You're listening to Paranormal Portal on Revolver Podcasts. Everybody, welcome to the Paranormal Portal podcast. I'm your host, Brent Thomas, and I'm absolutely thrilled you guys are here with me. Thank you so much for supporting the podcast and checking out the episodes and subscribing, because it's really growing incredibly fast. And it's a new venture for us here on the Paranormal Portal, but it's one that we are absolutely thrilled and excited to be undertaking. And you guys are definitely making it a success. So thank you so much. First and foremost, you guys are the spine and backbone of all of our endeavors. So today I got a great show lined up for you. I have a wonderful friend, an incredible researcher, and just one of the most meticulous people I've ever met. And this is Robin Moonshadow, who researches all things cryptid, but her specialty is little people. And I'm absolutely thrilled that to have found Robin. I kind of found her by accident a couple of years ago, because I was looking into doing shows on little people, and the information out there is just so sparse, and some of it's absolutely fantastical and wild and weird, and it's tied in folklore and legend and lore, and it's hard to find the real deal, the real phenomena. And I just happened to be catching a show, I think it was Xeno Hunters, and I because I listen to all these things online, and just happened to hear when Robin was interviewed on there. And I'm like, oh my God, this is who I need. This is who I've been looking for. And I reached out to Robin, and she graciously accepted my invitation to appear on the portal, and has been an amazing asset and inclusion ever since. So welcome to the show, Robin.
Hi, Brett. Thank you for having me. Hello, everybody.
And, you've done, first and foremost, you've done what I think is nothing short of a Herculean task, and that is to look into all the stories and folklore and legend and lore and pull information out of that, and to whittle away, a lot of the fantastic, and to, put together a body of research and work that is cohesive, it's informative, and it's sometimes shocking. You've done just an amazing job.
Thank you. Yeah, I love my proto-pygmy little people research. It's absolutely fascinating. And now that we're, scientists are finding bones of actual diminutive, not pygmies, diminutive little people, it just goes to show you, yep, they are here still.
Yeah, and they were here. And that's the cool thing. And, knowing that there is scientific substantiation, that's a lot of syllables, to this, really lends a lot of credibility to all these old stories that so many cultures around the world have had about these beings.
Absolutely. And I haven't found a culture yet that does not have stories about little people of some kind.
Yeah.
I mean, even the Mayans, mm-hmm. They call them Aluxes. The Aztecs called them excuse my pronunciation in case it's wrong, the Aztec called them Chuchuk.
Mm.
So they've been with us throughout human history.
And now, much like the Bigfoot phenomena, it's a worldwide phenomena. And that's what I find is most interesting, is that all of these disparate cultures and peoples from around the face of the world have some reference to these beings as part of their histories.
Oh, yeah, they absolutely do. Of course, what we know as leprechauns may be one of the most popular, but of course, they're part of the gnome family.
Mm.
Other than their clothes, of course, the descriptions aren't exactly like a gnome.
Now,
the gnome family is very diverse.
And of course, the gnomes, like what is popularly depicted in gardens across the world, these little diminutive beings with, well, sometimes red hats, sometimes other, but they wear these conical hats, and they seem to be almost, civilized. They're out there.
They are, and gnomes are fascinating because they live with us, they live beside us, they are in our homes, and yes, they are in our gardens, and they do look like a garden gnome. They're about 2 feet high, and they dress in what we would call clan colors, and even their hair depicts certain parts of their life. We know that younger girls that braid their hair before they're married, and with the gnomes, they'll have beards, but they don't grow them fully until they're older, after they're married.
That's so neat. And they, in many cases, well, there's two very specific spectrums of these proto pygmies and little people. There are the ones that seem to be benign and even benevolent to us, and then there's the ones that are very malevolent and dangerous to us.
Yes, and there's like you say, there's several types of proto-pygmies. The hairy little ones, who are often mistaken for juvenile Bigfoot, they are a menace. I have not read one story where they have been good. They're very primitive. And we're not talking monkeys. We're actually talking hairy little people.
Mm-hmm.
They harass people. I know of a story from Mexico, where they invade a farm, they'll steal chickens and house pets, and they will eat them.
Ooh.
And of course, we have the gnomes, and there's two aspects of the gnomes. We also have the red caps, and they are like what I call the anti-gnomes. They don't like people, they don't like animals, they will harass you, they will live on the outskirts in buildings, they will throw things at you. Rocks, broken glass. One story says that they were just walking through an abandoned building site, and all of a sudden they just got showered with broken glass. And when they looked up, they saw two of these little people, these mm-hmm. little red caps, mm-hmm. laughing and running off.
Jeez. Wow. That sounds like teenagers.
Yes, it is. And they will scare you on purpose. They will stick sticks in spokes of bikes to knock you down. They'll just run right out of nowhere. You won't see them coming because all these little people are fast.
Mm.
And they'll just stick a stick in the spoke of your bike. You'll go flying and they'll run off laughing.
Wow.
Now, what we should call the domestic gnomes, which is a house gnomes, and this type, don't do those things. They're more civilized because they have their own culture.
That is really
cool.
And then
we have the elves, which are small elves, more like Keebler elves, not like Lord of the Ring elves, because there are two types in Iceland and Scandinavia. And then we have the little Native American looking ones.
Right.
Which I was privileged to see for about 1.1 second in the Smoky Mountains in North Carolina, and they are very fast.
That is so wild. Now, a lot of these, I guess the benevolent ones, there's First Nations have many legends and stories of them living very much in cooperation with these little people and proto pygmies.
Yes, and in Alaska, as a collective name, they are called the urchin drag. And there are stories going back hundreds of years where they lived side by side with the Inuit or Eskimo when they would trade.
That is cool.
And then we hear again that they were being mistreated. So they just decided to go off and be by themselves.
And does that seem to be a theme that repeats through different cultures with as far as was there at one point cooperation and communication, and then there was some kind of dividing act or period?
Yes. When the first settlers, especially here in Canada and America, when the first settlers started coming here, they would start shooting at them, thinking that they were little devils or imps or some spawn of Satan. So they would shoot at them, even the benevolent ones who actually would have helped. And at some point they just got tired of this. And they went and they lived underground.
Oh, wow. That's so tragic. So tragic.
It is, because they could have helped.
Mm-hmm.
As the old stories go from not just my heritage being First Nations, but all of us, everyone that I've talked to said that when we first got here, little people were already here, as were the giants.
Mm. Yeah, that's a whole nother topic. and you know, the funny thing is that, you know, I think that we think that due to size, one thing is more dangerous than the other because, well, I mean, they're just 2 feet tall little things. I mean, you could just punt them like a football, I suppose. But in actuality, in many cases, the little ones that are malevolent are much more dangerous.
Yeah, because numbers overwhelm. Many times I have heard people would rather come into contact with a giant than be confronted by a whole bunch of little people, especially when it comes to the Pukwudgies.
Yeah, my God, those are probably, and you know, in my understanding, and I don't claim to have a real developed understanding of these things. Only, you know, largely what you've you know taught me through the times when I've had the opportunity to talk with you, but. The Pukwudgies seem to be about at the top of the danger meter.
Yeah, I believe that they are the most dangerous of the little people, because they will kill you. Mm-hmm. They hate us with a passion, and they will go out of their way to do us harm. Many stories, and besides gnomes, Pukwudgies mm-hmm. are the stories that I get the most. They are only a couple of feet high. They have a gray tone to their skin. And one gentleman told me that they would call his name out when he was walking his dog. And they will stalk you. They will watch you. Now, nobody knows what happens to you when they kidnap you or steal you. You just don't come back. It leans a little bit toward the fact that they might eat you. You just don't come back.
Hey, that is so creepy. Oh, my God. Ah, I suppose we would probably sustain them for quite a while.
It depends on how many Pukwudgies there would be in a tribe.
Oh, do you have any reports of what the general grouping size is of them?
Usually they'll travel... 5 or 6.
Oh, okay.
I would assume maybe that's a type of scouting party. They've learned a lot from First Nations over the years. Like I say, these guys are dangerous. They killed 2 giants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And they are sneaky smart. And they can talk. They watch you. They learn your routines. They stalk you.
So, yeah, and I suppose if we are prey, you know, potentially, then, you know, them being the hunters, they would learn all they could about the prey first and then, you know, decide to do what they're going to do.
Exactly. On one of the giants, they found out that he was allergic to pine nuts, and that's how they subdued him, and then they killed him.
So for the sake of the podcast audience, and I know this is a story you've shared on the live streams before, but You know, to any new listeners, can you give them that, the legend that you're referring to?
Okay. Well, the first giant, his name was, Moshop, and his wife was a little person, a different kind of a little person, not a Pukwudgie. Now the people loved Moshop. He, of course, like most giants, he had a bad temper and he was a little on the lazy side, but he was good. And he was good to the people. So they loved him. And the Pukwudgies got jealous of this type of love. And one time when Moshop went away on a trip, they started causing havoc in the village. Just, you know, setting fires and harassing the people. And they went to talk to Squint, who was Moshop's wife. Mm-hmm. And Moshop and Squint had a couple of sons, so she got them to go in and take care of it. Now, in some stories, the Pukwudgies kill the sons, and in other ones, they don't.
Okay.
Well, being devastated by the loss of their children, Squint and Moshop go to take care of the Pukwudgies. You know, he's a giant. He kills a lot of them, and he throws them all over. Mm-hmm. Well, he could probably throw them like a football. and that actually goes why we have some of them here in the Great Lakes region. Now, some of them come back, and then they're worse than ever. Mm-hmm. Then they start kidnapping people and taking people away. And again, doing the setting fires and harassing. Now, with Moshop, they trapped him in the lake, and they used poison arrows. So they poisoned him with these poison arrows, and he died.
Mm.
And Squid, being again devastated, she went back to her people. Now we know she's alive through another story.
Okay.
Now the second story, where the giant was allergic to pine nuts. Again, he was beloved by the people. And the Pukwudgies saw him as a threat to them.
Okay.
And every week he would go fishing at a certain spot at the same time. And they found out he was allergic to pine nuts because they listen and they watch. So they threw a whole bunch of these pine nuts down into this area. Now his allergy must have been really severe. So when he got close, they started throwing pine nuts into his canoe. And as if you have allergies, you know, it makes you very tired and very sleepy, mm-hmm. especially a severe allergy. So they started throwing the pine nuts down into his canoe. And as he started to feel sleepy, of course, he got closer to shore. And when he got close enough, a whole bunch of these Pukwudgies jumped down into his canoe and started beating him to death. With little axes or little tomahawks. Mm-hmm. And they did dispatch him.
Wow. And now how does the Squint come up in this story?
The story was that when you hear a certain type of bird, you know, these little people are around.
Oh.
One of her people came to talk to a medicine woman because Granny Squint, or excuse me, two different people. Squint was very sick. Mm. It's not specific what she was sick with, but they came to get the medicine woman and took the medicine woman underground with them, and the travel was like 2 days.
Oh, wow.
And Squint was very sick, and the medicine woman was able to heal her.
Oh, cool.
And as a reward for healing Squint, they gave her food, special kinds of food, and strawberries, probably wild strawberries, and a bunch of crystals because they took her underground.
Very cool. Wow. That's really intense. Granted, now for a lot of Westerners, hearing those First Nation stories may seem maybe allegorical or you know, metaphorical, but there's always truth in them.
And yes, and for our stories, mm-hmm. When we say something is a myth, it's a myth, it's a story. But when we say something is legend, mm-hmm. it's true.
Yeah, and it's awesome. I mean, those there's so much history in those references and in those memories that it's really cool that they survive even still today.
Yeah, because with the oral traditions and the oral legends, it's always passed down.
Mm-hmm. That is wild. Really cool. And so that's the background on that, ladies and gentlemen, the puck wedgies, of course. Can you describe what they look like? I know you said they were gray in tint, but...
Yeah, they have a gray tone to their skin. They have a pot belly. They're mistaken for little trolls, except for the ears. They don't have pointy ears. They have small ears. They have gray tone to their skin. They're about 2 feet high. They will wear a loincloth, but mostly they are barefooted.
And they're hairy.
And they're hairy, but not hairy like a Bigfoot hairy. They have hair on their arms. It's like somebody who hasn't shaved for a few years.
Now, oftentimes they are depicted having these spiny backs and stuff. When you see representations of Pukwudgie, you see these. They almost looks like it's a mane. Most of what I've seen on them is, you know, caricature or cartoonish. But you had shared a story of how that may have come to be. I don't know if you recall what I'm referring to, but there.
I do. Yes, okay. like all little people. They are the masters of camouflage. They will skin a raccoon, a porcupine, mm-hmm. and wear it as camouflage.
That's really brilliant because, you know,
Yeah, and especially if they're alone, because mm-hmm. alone they are vulnerable.
Right. And they would look like that animal, as, you know, given their size, and people would dismiss that. Oh, that's a raccoon. Oh, there goes a porcupine.
Yeah. Exactly.
I didn't know porcupines could run that fast, but wow. Because they're quick as well, right?
Yes, and they're very clever. They are. Don't ever underestimate a little person, especially a Pukwudgie, because there's always more than one.
Mm.
If they are separated, they won't be separated for long.
Mm-hmm. Right, so you might be chasing one down, and all of a sudden his friends come around, and then you're in a world of hurt.
Yeah, my American squatching partner, Dwight Campbell, actually has a picture of one.
Oh, fantastic.
A Pukwudgie, yes. And he told me that when he and his friend were in a certain area in North Carolina, they started hearing wood knocks, and it just echoed out around them, because he said that there were like 20 or 30 of these little guys all around them, banging on the trees. Messing with them, and I'm like, it's a good thing you weren't alone.
Yeah, well, even then you'd still want to get the hell out of there, right?
Yeah, at the time they didn't know what they were.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And he also has a picture of a Cherokee little person while he was in Uwari, I do believe it was, and he just got the feeling he was being watched, turned around and took a picture.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how I was actually able to get into contact with him, as he posted that picture. And I knew exactly what I was looking at when I saw it. It is a Cherokee little person. They are dressed in, it is either, I do believe it is bear fur or maybe squirrel fur. Like, these guys, again, are just 3 feet tops.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a war paint on.
Oh,
and you can clearly see his face. I mean, you can even see some of his feet if you look close enough. That are also covered in fur.
Wow, that is intense. So they're out there. And what range are we talking about for the Pukwudgies in North America?
Everywhere.
So there's nowhere that they couldn't be.
Exactly. They don't seem to like the cold quite as much.
I can't blame them.
Now, I haven't come across one. I haven't even found a footprint of a Pukwudgie, thank goodness, in my area, which is here in Ontario, Canada, and they are supposed to be here.
I was going to talk to you about how many different types do you suppose there are around. in just a ballpark figure, how many different species are we talking about that seem to live around us?
At least seven.
At least seven. And those are gnomes, puckwudgies, and the little natives, and...
The hairy ones.
The hairy ones.
Okay. We also have small elves that are like the Keebler elves.
Okay.
I have small trolls.
Small trolls. Wow.
And they look like a troll. If you've ever seen or even the cartoon of a gnome cartoon. I know when we were kids, it was on at least every year. Mm-hmm. And there was a book called just titled Gnomes. Mm-hmm. And within this book is the picture of a troll. And that's what they look like. Of course, they come in different colors for camouflage reasons. Some are a reddish color. Some are a greenish color. Some are black. Mm-hmm. And they are the atypical troll. They like to live away from people. They'll even live under bridges. They are habitual hoarders. Anything shiny, they'll take.
Wow.
So they're and they will eat your house pets. I got a report from England where she saw one stick its hand through a window because she lived on a lower floor, mm-hmm. and take her bird, and I don't know if it was a budgie or a parakeet or what, but take it right out of the cage and gone with it.
Hey.
it had a green tongue to its skin. And when she described the hand to me, I'm like, that's a troll, because it doesn't matter what color they are. Their nails are black.
Wow. So they're a lot like, what was I going to say? I had some quippy little remark to make, but I forgot it. So
like the trolls we get online, I have no doubt.
But I often picture them as grotesque little things as well. So
causing havoc and harassing people.
Yeah, exactly. But these things are all over, and there's the benevolent and there's the malevolent. By what percentage do you suppose that we have the good versus the bad? Is it literally like a 50-50 split when you look at all seven types, or do they tend to be not as good for us?
Well, the good little ones, like the gnomes and the smaller elves, are good.
Okay.
Okay, but I think it's about 50-50 split.
Okay, because again,
but what you should never do, even with the good ones, is make them mad. They all have terrible tempers.
Right. Yeah. It's always the little people do. No, I'm just kidding. That's poor taste, I suppose. I don't mean that in a disparaging way, but I mean, you think about these little things. Even in cartoons, they're depicted as happy-go-lucky, but once they're mad, they're like pissed, you know, and so that's what I meant by that remark, but it came out sounding like I was being a jerk about shorter people, and that wasn't my intent at all.
It is a continuing theme, even with gnomes. Gnomes are good little people. Be respectful to them. If they come into your home, it's because they've picked you for a reason.
Uh-huh.
You will have luck while they're in your home. They will look after your pets.
Oh, that's cool. Now, they also don't like mistreatment of pets, though.
They do not like mistreatment of pets or children.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And I wish there were more of them around.
from what I understand, gnomes are actually quite strict when it comes to their own children.
Oh, okay.
So if you stand your child in the corner on a timeout for just a couple of minutes, they actually might not think that that is strict enough. They might want you to take a switch to the kid's backside.
Oh. They're a little old-fashioned then, right?
A little old-fashioned, yep. When it comes to gnomes, it's just remember this is their culture.
Right.
And these are the things that they do, whether we agree or disagree, it is their culture.
Right, exactly. Now we are going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, I want to get into more about these elves, these diminutive elves, because I think that we haven't really discussed that so much, and I'm curious as to more about them, if you don't mind. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Thank you. All right, everybody, we are back and back at it. And for Robin and I, that seemed like just a fraction of a second. But for all of you, it might have seemed a little longer. The beauty of editing and all.
A diminutive amount of time.
That's right. We do everything quickly. We're a little gnome-like, I guess. But before the break, you had mentioned, and this has come up a couple times in today's show, and I think this is really, really incredibly interesting about these Keebler elf kind of elves. Now, what are they exactly, and how are they distinct from gnomes and the other ones?
Before we continue, all these little people are considered humans. They're just diminutive humans who choose not to live side by side with us. They live in their own cultures and in their own ways. Mm-hmm. Now, there are two types of elves. We have the tall ones that are very beautiful and fair, usually blonde. So when you think of an elf, think of Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
The tall ones, like Legolas.
Sure.
And then you have the small ones, who are actually like Keebler elves, but are in the same way. These guys are only about 3 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And they are very beautiful. We're talking green eyes, blue eyes, whichever the color it is, it's the water, or their eyes are like water. They are very intense. Hmm. Even their pupils are very intense. They do have pointed ears, which I always find amusing. And they are very meticulous. They are very regal. They are considered very beautiful beings, whether it is the tall ones or the short ones.
That's really wild.
There is actually one story, and it is my favorite story. And I do believe it is Pennsylvania. I might be wrong, where a boy had just wandered off from his parents to look at nature, look at some trees. And he came across a strange little boy playing a flute. And as he approached him, there was an air about him, that he was just a little bit different. And again, as he got closer, he could see the little boy had these green eyes, pointed ears, dressed very nicely. And even his voice was different. Mm-hmm. Very airy. And this little elf boy asked the other little boy if he wanted to play. And of course, we'll say human boy for posterity reasons to keep the two different, said he couldn't because he had to get back to his parents. Mm-hmm. But it's not the only sighting of these smaller elves. A family, a mother, a father, and I don't remember if it was a little boy or a little girl, was simply walking in the woods and they saw one of these little elves. And he was doing something beside a tree. And again, the description was almost the same, except that the hair color was different. Wow. But when they approached him, of course, he took off.
That's incredible. And so they're out there too. But again, that's, I was familiar with the first story that you had shared, and I think that's incredible. And I've often wondered what that was. I guess I never realized that was a diminutive elf. But really, they seem to be either much more wily and evasive, or I guess it's because they're benevolent that they don't get in the way or interfere, and they're just either benign towards us or they're, you know, benevolent, but they're not like, you know, we hear about Pukwudgies and things like that because they are actively engaging us in a, you know, in a negative way, I suppose. But mm-hmm. but these other, the benevolent types, they seem to, you know, either just remain hidden or just evade completely us. And by that, I mean benevolent in the fact that they don't go out of their way to harm us. They don't do anything to try to engage us. And so that's really, really interesting. And I really like, I mean, this is a topic I'm incredibly passionate about. I wish I could understand more of it, and I wish I knew the whole picture of what was going on. But I think that just hearing about these things And just hearing about the possibilities of them, to me, just creates a world of magic all around us. And I think that that is nothing short of exciting and you know, brilliant.
Oh, yes, because there's more out in the woods than just Bigfoot.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's the thing.
It's, and I find a lot of us have to stop putting everything into the Bigfoot category, because what you might see as a Bigfoot might be something completely different.
Right, or even, you know, as you mentioned, with, you know, the red caps and stuff that they like to throw stuff. Well, how many times have people reported being, you know, having small pebbles thrown at them or sticks? They never see the Bigfoot, but they chalk it up as, well, that's a Bigfoot. There's a Bigfoot nearby, and it very well might not be.
Yeah, like we were speaking just recently that when I was casting some little people footprints, I'd had rocks thrown at me. And it wasn't from high up, it was from down low. That was my own fault because I didn't ask for permission to cast the tracks or leave them a treat to say thank you. Oh. I did after, just sometimes when I find these little diminutive prints, I get very excited and forget.
Well, you know, and it is like the probably like the Holy Grail for what you're doing, because it's definitely substantiable proof. It represents the journey and the work that you're doing. So I can't blame you for being excited. And I just shared a picture with you as well. Ladies and gentlemen, what I shared with Robin was we had investigated a tree structure near here, a very unique tree structure, and it's more of a dome shape, and really quite interesting. But near there, we found what looked like a Bigfoot print. Now, it was on an incline, so it couldn't be casted. It was going uphill, but and I took a bunch of pictures of it. And when I got home, I was doing a little bit of color balancing just to make sure that it was definitely able to represent what it was I was taking a picture of as best I could. But as I've got it, you know, in Photoshop looking at it, I'm realizing, what's that inside of the print? And I looked down and I zoomed in, and it is unmistakably a little barefoot. And it's about 3.5 inches long. I don't know. I'm guesstimating here, but it's really quite small. And at that time when I first saw it, I thought, well, man, they must have had a little baby there. But then as I'm thinking about it, you know, of course, Bigfoot is named Bigfoot because they have big feet. And, you know, the size of this print would have been much like an infant or at least a very young child. And in human terms, wouldn't have been at walking height yet, but it was on an incline going up an embankment, going up the start of a side of a mountain. So I'm pretty sure nobody had their little child out there, you know, barefoot walking up a side of a mountain through the scrub and everything. And, you know, even helping it or holding its hand, but it occurred to me, God, you know, this could very well be a little person print. So I shared that with Robin today. And, it, you know, it's really exciting to think that they were right there as well, you know. And now, Robin, you've mentioned the fact that there seems to be at least a suggestion that there's a cooperation between these two very different species.
Oh, yeah, it went with Bigfoot and little people. They live in the same areas. There is no competition for food.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But usually there won't be little people where there's a dog man that is a threat to them.
Oh, sure. Yeah, Dogman seems to be a threat to pretty much everything except Bigfoot.
Yeah, yeah, so with big feet and the little people, they coexist in the same areas. Many times I've found Bigfoot tracks with little people tracks near them, and they are not juvenile Bigfoot. There is a big difference. Bigfoot, as you know, don't wear shoes. Mm-hmm. The picture that Brett has, is this little person is wearing a moccasin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is what I've casted at my prints lately, of little people wearing moccasins. The ones in my area, I do believe that they are called Maskoweski, the typical size for an adult little person is 4 inches. Yeah. For my casts, I have a 4-inch, a 3-inch, and a 2-inch. Now the 3-inch, it throws me. It could be a female, or it could be a younger one, but the 2-inch that I have is just absolutely adorable, and it's definitely a baby.
Wow.
Or very young.
That is so cool.
Yeah, of course, we don't know how big they are when they are born, like if they're the size of puppies or kittens, considering they're only 2 or 3 feet tall, full grown.
Right. That is amazing. And so it's exciting for me that I might have actually helped contribute to your body of research a little bit, but you know, and you've suggested they're here too. And I don't doubt you for a moment. It's just, I've never come across anything that I could, you know, at least suggest could be a little person until this picture. And even then I did this, you know, the same thing that most people do. It's like, well, there's a big footprint and then there's a little footprint. So they must be the same thing, just different sized. But, you know, after having discussions with you, excuse me, and learning that they do, you know, live in cooperation or at least in the same areas, you know, it just occurred to me like, oh my gosh, this could be part of, you know, what she's talking about. And there you go. And
Yes, I understand that a lot of Bigfoot researchers misidentify the tracks as well, but they are very different. Like I said, Bigfoot don't wear shoes. You'll find that a juvenile Bigfoot has a wider foot. And of course, bigger, of course. Like I have a 6-inch juvenile foot where you can, the toes are quite distinctive, but it's very wide.
Yes.
Even as a young Bigfoot, it's very wide.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's interesting about this print as well, is that the I'm just zooming into it now and looking at it as we're talking, and the heel on this is quite narrower pointed by what it looks like, because the litter, the pine needle litter and stuff is actually pushed out of this track by itself. It wasn't done by me or anybody with me, but it definitely shows a motion then. But the rear of that track is definitely more pointed, where that heel must have pushed off.
Yes, and even with the moccasins that I have, they are a little bit pointy at the back where they were sewn together.
Uh-huh.
And of course, little people aren't very heavy, so it is very hard to find tracks. Again, this is why I get so excited. Even the very first track that I found in upstate New York, I had to look at it twice. It was only one print near the edge of a bank, and it would have walked up onto the sticks or makeshift beaver dam what was there. And I looked at it, I'm like, oh yeah, cool. and even that one was a moccasin, which the little native kind wear. And they will also wear sandals depending on the type of year.
Oh, sure, I suppose. Yeah, they must have winter shoes and summer shoes just like we do.
Yeah, I would assume that these might be wooden bottoms.
Oh.
Which also make them a little bit heavier.
Oh, good point. Yeah. Very interesting. Now, before you had mentioned about house gnomes, and I think we should spend just a little bit talking about that, if you don't mind. But this is of course a topic that I find it really, really cool, because they, you know, they can be in our living areas and stuff. Now, how does that work though? Because you know, if they were 2 feet little beings walking around, eventually you'd think we would see them. Do they go invisible, or how does this work?
They don't go invisible. You just don't see them because they are so fast. For some of us who have pets, you might think that the pet is behind you when it's not. They'll live in the walls, the attic, the basement. And if they do pick your house, it is very good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I said, they'll look after your pets.
And I imagine that looking with the in history and legend, there's the tales of them actively helping people. In one case, there was a story that came out of, I think it was out of Russia. I know that out of, I think the old USSR. And there was this woman who, as I recall it, and I'm paraphrasing the story, so I apologize if I'm really brutalizing this as I go, but as I remember it, she was once aristocratic, but in the, you know, in the whole Soviet takeover and stuff, she was relegated to this rural living and had to live like a pauper. And she was able to obtain a cow. And so she lived on her own, and she was a bit elderly, but she would get this. It was a milking cow, and she would bring it out and find the best grasses for it and then milk it and then fill up milk bottles and, you know, distribute them. And people would come buy her milk. And it was kind of illegal in the old Soviet bloc, but I think most people looked the other way, as I recall. Now, as she would be walking along, bringing her cow to the best patches of grass she could find, she would see these little diminutive milk bottles put out. And so she would stop and fill them quick. And she did this religiously as a matter of practice. Now, it doesn't suggest that she knew these were little people or not, or at least I don't recall that part, but she did it just because it looked like a little milk bottle. And she just thought, well, maybe it would be a good omen to do that. So she would continually do that. And then there came an accident where she was, she had broke her leg and was unable to take care of her cow or anything. And what had happened was she was transported to hospital and was away from home for several weeks. And during this time, she was just frantic and beside herself and didn't know what to do. Because she was sure that her cow would be, you know, probably dead when she got home and she was just in a bad place. But apparently when she came home, her cow was doing well. There was a pile of money on the table that had been collected from all of her milk runs. And with a little note that said, "Thank you for helping to take care of us. Now we have taken care of you." And she apparently assumed it was from these little people whom she had been supplying milk for.
Well, see, I wouldn't be surprised by that. There are several types of gnomes who have different jobs. We have the house gnome or the domestic gnome who lives in your house. Mm-hmm. And then we have the ones that live on the farm or in the farm, and they help take care of your animals. Mm-hmm. Now, if you help a little person, they will always be grateful.
Yeah, I think that's just a magical story, though. And granted, ladies and gentlemen, I can't vouch for its authenticity or anything. It could be it could just be creative writing. But what if it is true? What if it is true? Then there's definitely a lot going on that we don't understand, and that's the foundation of the paranormal portal. It's like, I don't know that everything we report or cover is true, but I believe it is, and I really think there is so much to this world that we just don't understand. And what does it harm to embrace these ideas? Nothing. If anything, your existence just got a hell of a lot more interesting.
Yeah, well, especially with this story, it is possible. Mm-hmm. And well, we know that most little people love animals. I was just on the Mohawk Reservation recently and given a story of just near this location, her mother has a farm and owns horses. And every once in a while, when she goes out in the morning to feed her horses, their manes will be braided. Now, this is and I have heard this many, many times before from other First Nations. They love horses. Mm-hmm. But you're not to take those braids out because the little people will be offended.
Oh.
And the horses love the little people back.
Do you think that they could perhaps even be telepathic?
No, but I think perhaps the elves might be. Oh. Because there was too much coming from Iceland, Greenland, and over there. Mm-hmm. When you start hearing the same things over and over again that's not folklore, then there is something to it.
Do you believe these elves are magical?
No.
Okay.
I think what we see as magic is just simply them being themselves. And of course, because we can't explain it, it seems sure. Very magical to us. The fact that they may disappear and disappear. Mm-hmm. It is because they're so fast.
Oh, okay.
But so, if somebody else wants to choose that they're magical and this is part of their culture, that's okay with me.
Yeah, well, for sure. I mean, and you're right. It's a matter of perception. What we don't understand, we often attribute to magic, and that crosses the board of things we don't understand. Unless you're talking about science, of course, then it's just undiscovered science. But
this is true. Unless I actually see them do something magical, yes. Do I believe it is possible? Maybe. But because my brain is geared more towards science things. Mm-hmm. This is how I see it.
And, I think that's really incredible because, you are dealing with a subject matter that most, quote unquote sciences would scoff at. It's just a flight of fancy. But the neat thing is, like you had mentioned earlier, we are finding examples of these little people having been here. And so if they have been here, why can't they still be here?
Right. And we even have the stories to follow. Mm-hmm. from the past, we'll say Homo floresiensis, who was the Hobbit.
Yes.
He was, or she, about 4 feet tall. They weighed 70 pounds. And what we get from the locals are stories of the Ibugogo, who fit the description. They were, again, hairy little people. They were a menace. They could barely talk. They would murmur and make noises and carry on. And then after a while, they started stealing children and eating them. And the villagers got tired of this. And they trapped them in the cave and burned them alive. Mm. But stories of these little people still come out of that area today.
Wow.
So and you're to be cautious because they'll eat you.
That's about the most horrible thought ever, is that, you know, we could be on the menu. I don't know. I mean, as a person, I think about the thing that I would be fearful the most is the fact that I could become food for something, you know?
Yeah. Something smaller than us, and we can't really do much about it because numbers overwhelm.
Well, it's like, you know, the idea is that I've been through all that I've been through in my life, and this journey has been an incredible experience. And, you know, it seems like a lot of effort to become a burger at the end of the day, you know? So.
And then we have the new one that was just announced in April, and that's Homo Luzon. And he's, they seem to have more information about him.
Okay.
The family was found in Callao Cave, well, I should say their bones, their remains. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these guys were about 30 pounds, and they're probably responsible for the hand stencils and pictographs that are on the rocks there. Now, these guys actually used tools. Oh. So it shows their level of intelligence was higher than, we'll say, the Ibugogo.
Now, what do you think are the possibilities of, you know, of course, we hear about Neanderthal DNA being in a lot of our modern DNA. And so it demonstrates that there was, you know, a mingling of species at some point in the ancient past. What is the possibility of that having been the case in, you know, in some of these other places, like perhaps even the Philippines or Indonesia? Do you think there was ever any instances of that? And so it could... And I don't know what the hell I'm trying to say, but, you know, of course, all of us from these disparate regions, we look a little bit different, and there's nothing right or wrong with that. It's just a fact of, you know, our development and stuff through the ages. But is it possible that there was ever any instances of crossbreeding?
Oh, absolutely. Even the story said that some of these adult size humans would breed with these little people. Mm-hmm. And for Neanderthal DNA, we heard for years and years and years that, no, it's not possible. Neanderthals could not breed with humans. Well, they could breed, but they wouldn't produce offspring. And now we see over these last few years, they're showing that it is possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And
so, and especially with these little people showing up in Asia and the Philippines, they don't know how they got there. And it's not always a case of... island dwarfism, where you shrink to the environment. Oh. I think that we all look different because of our heritage, of course, and sure. We adapt for our environment. I know science likes to think that we adapt the environment to fit us. Mm-hmm. City-wise, we build, sure, but I'm... Well, when I was younger, I was 5'6", very tall, very slim. This goes with my DNA, where my sister is very small. Hmm. And she's older, but she's very small. She also has blonde hair, where I have black hair.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, well, there's five of us kids. I mean, the two blondes are in the middle, and the rest of us have black hair. but I do believe that the opposite is that we adapt for our environment.
Sure.
And of course, I live in Canada, you know, I'm a little bit smaller because when you're taller, you get colder in colder weather. And when you're shorter, you keep the heat in.
Oh, yeah, there might be something to that. That's a good point. I'd never heard of that before, but that's very, very interesting. But I think we've had an incredible journey here today, and I'm really really excited that you've been on the podcast now. This is something I was really looking forward to when I knew we were going to start doing podcasting. You were one of the first names to jump into my head. It's like, oh, I can't wait to introduce the podcast to this topic because it's not often covered. And there aren't, quite honestly, because I believe there aren't a lot of people that know what the hell's going on. And so you're definitely a diamond in this world of confusion for this topic. Absolutely.
Thank you. And I do love talking about the proto pygmies. And if you have a story or an encounter, you can always contact me. Or if you're curious to know what kind might be in your area, I have a database.
Oh, yes. And let people know how to stay in touch with you.
Yeah, you can find me on Facebook. It's Strange Realms. I have a blog. I know it's very late, but I am getting to it. It's just summer is coming, and I get extremely busy. And this year, it is really busy because I have a lot of trips planned. But you can find me on my blog. Again, it's strangerealms.net. Mm-hmm. And you can always check out my YouTube channel, and you can watch me go squatching by myself or with my friends. And, of course, we go hobbiting. And that's what I call it when we go looking for little people. and again, it's Strange Realms.
Yeah. So look for Strange Realms, ladies and gentlemen, and follow Robin. Her blog is full, just jam-packed with incredible research and references and historical factors. It's an amazing journey, and I promise you, if you visit her site, you're going to be there for a while because, I mean, she's just done a marvelous job. And once again, Robin, thank you so much for being here and being a part of the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks. Now, ladies and gentlemen, make sure you're subscribed to the podcast. And of course, you can check us out on youtube.com/paranormalportal. And you can find us on Facebook at at facebook.com/paranormalportalradio. And I hope you all are doing wonderful and continue to check out the shows. I love you all. Be good, be kind, be nice. Take care of each other and help each other out. Find the magic in every day and remember to laugh as much as you can. Take care, everybody.
Hi, this is Don with Paranormal Portal. Thank you for checking out our Paranormal Portal podcast. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to our YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/paranormalportal. And follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/paranormalportalradio.
sports betting is sweeping across the country faster than the coronavirus, and Wagering Week is your antidote. I'm Tom Barton, and I'm a veteran sports analyst and respected sports handicapper who helped build ESPN's brand. I've been recognized and awarded by Pro Football Weekly and Gaming Today magazine as the honest handicapper. Let the other guys give you the same old boring sports talk with the same tired storylines. We'll give it to you straight here every Friday on Wagering Week. Don't gamble with other podcasts. Let Sports Garden Network's Wagering Week help your bottom line.